New cabinet appointments need another round of confirmation hearings in the Senate. If key Republicans get their way, it could also mean the end of the filibuster. Republicans claim that Democrats abused this talking tool by blocking 10 of the president's 229 judicial nominees last term. In a speech last month, Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist called this tactic, quote, a formula for tyranny by the majority. Democrats say they would fight any effort to end the filibuster. If a change should happen, they will find a way to strike back. We'll also be talking about how some congressional freshmen got assigned their committees. But let's take an historical look at the filibuster. Joining us now is Donald Ritchie, an associate historian at the Senate Historical Office. He joins us by phone from his office here in Washington. Welcome back.
Thank you.
Tell us how the filibuster first got started, and how does it work?
Well, the word filibuster is from the Dutch for pirate. It came into being in the 1840s. But actually, we probably have had filibusters way before there was a term for it, because in the very first Congress, there's a report that some senators were trying to talk a bill to death.
Mm-hmm.
The big difference between the House and the Senate is that the rules of the House allow the bigger body to operate efficiently as long as the majority sticks together. The rules of the Senate allow the minority to have a greater voice. And so that's part of the balancing between the two bodies. And a filibuster essentially is designed to keep the majority from ever getting to cast a vote on an issue. In other words, if the majority was able to vote, they need is a simple majority, 51, to prevail. But if you use the rules in such a way that you slow things down or you obstruct the process, eventually either the majority will have to give up on that issue, or they'll have to figure out what it is that you're objecting to and see if they can accommodate you in some way.
Now, this is, I guess, the most famous filibuster anybody remembers is, of course, the one in the movies, Jimmy Stewart and Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. But it doesn't quite work that way as a rule, does it?
No, that Jimmy Stewart, one person standing up for many hours and then fainting at the end, it has happened. We actually had a senator fainted during a filibuster. But
did Claude Rains come in to sobbingly confess at the end?
Not exactly. But that's not the way that filibusters normally happen. Filibusters actually take place over a long period of time. Sometimes no one is speaking at all. It's just a matter of enough senators vote against a cloture motion. So, in fact, there's been no debate. And sometimes it's just a senator saying, I object, objecting to unanimous consent agreement. That slows the process down. Or putting a hold on something, just saying that they would object to a unanimous consent agreement if there was one. Or more likely, there would be, say, teams of senators who would be holding the floor for a period of time. The longest filibuster we ever had was in 1964, and it went on for 87 days. And that was against the Civil Rights Act of 1964. And once that was broken and once cloture was established, it changed things up here in a lot of ways. One was that once the moral stigma of civil rights and segregation was taken off of filibusters, then liberals started to filibuster as well as conservatives. Before that, it had almost always been conservative Southern Democrats who were filibustering. And also after that, the rules were changed so that cloture was reduced from 2/3 to 3/5. And that was supposed to make it easier for the majority to get its way. What it's made it is easier often for leaders to file cloture motions.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have lots more cloture motions now than we ever had before.
And cloture is simply a word for closing off debate. In other words, there's open-ended debate in the Senate until the senators agree to stop it. It takes that 60 votes or that kind of a majority to shut off debate on an important vote. Therefore, for most important votes, it takes 60 votes, not 51.
That's correct. And there was no cloture available until 1917. All throughout the 19th century, there was no way of cutting off a debate. And it was President Woodrow Wilson who prevailed on the Senate to adopt its first cloture motion about the time of World War I, because he saw that isolationists were obstructing his efforts to rearm the country as we were going into the war.
We're talking with Senate historian Donald Ritchie about changes proposed in Senate rules. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And Donald Ritchie, exactly what is it that Majority Leader Frist is proposing to change?
Well, he hasn't formally proposed anything, but the suggestion is that it would be a movement against filibustering on nominations, on judicial nominations, and that it would provide for a sort of a sliding scale of cloture votes, so that each time cloture was voted, fewer senators would be required to vote until eventually a majority of senators could cut off a debate. Interestingly, in the past, actually, there have been proposals to reduce cloture to a simple majority, and when it was last proposed, it was proposed by liberal Democrats back in the 1970s, right after the Watergate, when the Democrats increased their majority, and you had people like Walter Mondale and others who were leading the motion to do away with the two-thirds majority. They suggested reducing it to a simple majority. Democratic leader Mike Mansfield at the time, who was the majority leader, represented a small state. And Montana is large in geography but small in population. And the smaller states have always felt that the filibuster was one of their defenses against the larger states because the larger states prevailed in the House and the smaller states felt that their best defense was in the Senate.
On to another subject. Tis the season for new committee assignments. The incoming Democrats, at least in the Senate, have found out what committees they're going to be on. How does this work?
The committee assignments are made by the party conferences. Before we had standing committees, the senators used to elect all the committees, and then when they finally created standing committees, the two-party conferences took over appointing people. And each one has their own rules for doing it, their own structure for doing it. Essentially, the two leaders have a large say in who goes on what committees in their conferences. And their problem, of course, is that they have all the new senators all want the same assignments. They all want to be on appropriations or they all want to be on finance, and there are just so many seats. So you have to figure out what the best assignments would be for those senators and what would strengthen them in their home states and what would appeal to their particular legislative interests.
Mm-hmm. What about third parties? There's an independent, Jim Jeffords in the Senate and Bernie Sanders in the House of Representatives. How do they organize?
Well, any third party senator or representative has to sit with one of the two major parties or else not serve on a committee. So Bernie Sanders in the House and Jim Jeffords in the Senate sits with the Democratic Conference. In the past, when we had, say, James Buckley, a conservative from New York, he sat with the Republican Conference. But essentially, it's the two-party conferences that hand out those assignments, and so they have to find some way of cooperating with one of the major parties.
As you mentioned, freshman senators come in with their own wish list, appropriations being very high on it. What do they usually get?
Well, they get a better deal than they used to get. Traditionally, the incoming senators would never get onto the A-list committees like appropriations. They would always wind up on committees like the District of Columbia Committee, where they were supposed to bide their time, learn the ropes, and then after a while they would be appointed to a better committee. But since Lyndon Johnson's days, back in the 1950s, the leaders have tried to put every new incoming senator on at least one solid A committee. And in recent years, they've tried to find for the majority party one subcommittee for them to chair and for the minority party one subcommittee for them to be the ranking member on. Because you spend most of your time in committee assignments, and that's one way that you can get some visibility. And it's helpful to the party to build up that senator's expertise and reputation as soon as they can.
Donald Ritchie, thanks as always.
My pleasure.
Donald Ritchie, Associate Historian at the Senate Historical Office, joined us by phone from his office here in Washington. I'm Neil Conan, NPR News.